Hi, this is Len Testa from the Disney Dish with Jim Hill podcast. Hey, if you like what we're doing here, and by we I mean Jim, head over to disneydish.bandcamp.com where we've got tons of exclusive episodes recorded live with Jim and me in the parks earlier this year. It's hours and hours of fun, background music, and if we could figure out a way to do it, the smell of hot dogs and tourists mixing in the air. That's all available at disneydish.bandcamp.com. And hey, thanks for listening. Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide to Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. This is our first May episode for 2015, and we have some really fun stuff to talk about today. Earlier this year, one of us, and by one of us I mean not me, was able to get a hard hat tour of the new Springfield, USA area going up at Universal Studios Hollywood, and to talk about how The Simpsons grew like cartoon kudzu across the Universal Studios landscape. Here to talk about it is Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
Still trying to get the smell of tourists and hot dogs out of my nostrils, Len, but beyond that, fine. It was actually, I have to thank the folks at Universal Creative. I was in there, that was the early part of April. They were
a couple weeks ago.
They have since begun actually soft opening the park, but it was, it was a wonderful morning just to sort of get to wander around the buildings that they're doing down there, because it really is a step up from what they've been what they did in Florida.
But, really? But
very much so. For example, the attention to detail is really kind of insane in this version. Their fast food area, which features Cletus's Chicken Shack and Krusty the Clown, a Krusty burger, what they've decided to do is, because, and this is the other neat aspect of it, Springfield, USA out in Hollywood basically is the berm for their version of the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, Hogsmeade.
So it's the boundary.
Yeah. So what they've done is, rather than going back deep, what they've done is they've built up. So, Springfield is the berm that hides Harry Potter from the area, sort of the crossover area between the lower lot and the upper lot, and where you take the escalator down to the tram tour.
Right.
They've done some really fun things by putting, you get your food downstairs and then are encouraged to go upstairs to the dining room. So, for example, in Krusty Burger, when you're up on the second floor, you can actually go into the employee cafeteria at Krusty Lou Studios.
What's that like?
Well, for example, you have, a bronze set of Krusty's first clown shoes, the baby size. And the walls are actually covered with these caricatures, very much in the style of, sort of what you see in, the Brown Derby.
Brown Derby, yeah.
Yeah, but it's what's great about this is these are the actual artists who work on The Simpsons Show who came over and drew these caricatures on the walls.
So they didn't just ship over a bunch of picture frames with caricatures in them.
No, and in fact, that's what's genuinely cool about this is that key difference between what was done in Florida and what was done in Hollywood is that in order to for a James Brooks or a Matt Groening to do the to get involved in the, the actual making of the Florida one, meant a plane trip. It meant, traveling 3,000 miles and,
right, because they're all based in California.
That's it, exactly. This, they drive over, and it,
it's Tuesday afternoon. I'm going to head over to see what's going on.
And so now it just, because they were so much more involved, so much hands on with this version, it was, it's reached a genuinely nutty detail. For example, in this version, there's an office facing into the street, a picture window where you can look in, and it's Homer's workstation from the Springfield Nuclear Power Plant. And there's actually a button you can hit that starts there's a set of drums that have nuclear waste in them. You can hit a button that makes them start to move and induce a crisis at the Springfield Nuclear Power Plant. In fact, that when I was there, they were actually talking about how they had begun testing. Evidently, every half hour, there's going to be a nuclear crisis.
And, it's like Japan all over again. All right.
Well, there you go. But the lights will flash, you know, the sirens will wail, and you know, just at the last minute, they'll avert the meltdown. But it's just sort of like, this is kind of what this is like. If you are a Simpsons fan, this is the place you have to go.
So they've got the Krusty Burger place. They've got Cletus's Chicken Shack. Is there a Moe's Tavern?
Yes. You know, and in fact, what's kind of interesting about the Moe's Tavern is it's just that little bit bigger. I mean, again, remember what they did in Florida is they took, the International
Film and Food Festival. The worst restaurant in the world.
Sorry.
Jim sneezes into the microphone. I'll edit that out. All right. Mm-hmm. So it's the International Film and Food Festival. The worst restaurant in the park.
Yeah, and what they really did is that, I mean, you have to remember that prior to the changeout, that just to back things up a little bit, there's kind of a convoluted path as to why Springfield, USA was built at Universal Studios Florida. For starters, a lot of it really can be tracked back to, you know, just prior to, when they shut down Back to the Future and were doing the change out, they took a gift shop that was next to the Back to the Future ride building and changed it to the Quickie Mart.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is where the construction fences, you know, that were themed to Back to the Future, you know, kind of linked out to. And Universal was really kind of startled when they did this because, you know, part of it was brilliant timing on their part because, if you remember, summer of 2007 was when finally the Simpsons movie finally came out.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of the promotion for this, a number of 7-Elevens around the country changed themselves into Quickie Marts for a 2 to 3 week period and saw their sales just quintuple. I mean, people had to come in and get the giant pink donuts and, you know, that wanted, you know, all of this theme material. And Universal did it inside, you know, took this one store and turned it into Quickie Mart and watched how it became a photo op. And, you know, again, they were doing quintuple sales from what they previously did. Well, and it's like, oh.
Well, doesn't everyone refer to, like, the generic convenience store? It used to be, you know, let's go down to 7-Eleven or let's go to Circle K. Doesn't everyone refer to a generic convenience store now as the Quickie Mart?
Well, that's...
it's entered the vernacular.
Yeah, I mean, it just... And that's what's kind of startling about The Simpsons. I mean, it's just that they have... That's how ingrained they've become. So, anyway, and as you recall, I mean, you know, remember the theming for the Simpsons ride is you're entering Krusty Land, so you're going, you're going under that 32 foot tall head of Krusty the Clown. You're walking on the spongy surface that's supposed to be his tongue, and to either side of the entrance were these sort of faux carnival games, that were, you know, Simpsonified. But now you jump ahead to it's 2011. Universal knows that they're soon going to be pulling down Jaws the Ride and turning that area into, the Wizarding World of Harry Potter Diagon Alley.
Yeah.
But here's the problem. The area that surrounded Jaws, Amity, was where Universal had put all of its carnival games. And that's a really lucrative revenue stream.
Is it really?
Well, I mean, think about it. When you're a family member who didn't want to go on the Jaws ride and you're looking to kill time, you know, for a dollar or two here, a dollar or two there, you know, and you end up with a giant sawdust-filled minion. And again, how much does sawdust cost, Len?
it's practically a renewable resource, Jim.
There we go.
Practically.
All right, so you're in this situation where all of that's got to go because, again, J.K. Rowling insists on, you know, authentic fiction.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are no carnival, you know, games in London. So Universal was looking for a place to move these things over to and, you know, look across the way and let's go, look, we have fake games over there. Why don't we retheme these around the Simpsons? And drop them in over there. And then it just kind of gathered momentum because they'd really enjoyed working with Matt Groening and James L. Brooks on the Simpsons ride. And, you know, those guys had really loved how hyper-detailed Universal had gone with this thing. In fact, Mike West...
Oh, yeah, the number of gags in that. You can't see it all in probably in 10 rides.
Well, Mike West tells this story. I mean, you face it, when he was the former Imagineer who, in fact, his first project through the door at Universal is the Simpsons ride.
Wow.
And, you know, that the other story that Mike loves to tell is that, you know, as the ride film was being made was when the 2007-2008 Writers Guild strike happened. And, you know, and so anybody who was in the Writers Guild couldn't work during this period. They were supposed to be out marching but as it turns out, the language of the Writers Guild contract made no mention at all of theme park work. So basically the entire staff of the Simpsons just pivoted, and it's like, okay, we can't do the TV show. Let's work on the ride film. And so, you know, Mike would go over to visit with the guys at Gracie to, okay, so you've been punching up the storyboards. And it's like, he'd come in and they would have changed out like 2/3 of the gags. And he said, don't get me wrong, they were better gags. But it's like, I have to get this animated. I've got to get the guys at Blur and Real Effects to get working on this. And if you're, you know, finally in the late winter of 2008, he had to just finally, guys, you can't keep improving.
Yeah, this is done, yeah.
This is done. But he said, but as a direct result, there were things in it that he, you know, Mike talked about he was on basically his 100th ride on the thing as they were programming the simulator. And it was, there's a point where you're, as the ride is beginning, where you're up at the top of the roller coaster, where there are these flags that are sort of fluttering off of the roller coaster. And Mike noticed, again, on the 100th ride, it's like, wait a minute, one of those flags is Bart's underwear. But again, the guy who did the ride didn't even notice that they had snuck this in there till his 100th ride.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's the insane level of detail for this attraction. But yeah, so you know, so now you're moving, you know, the games over there. And like you said, you've got this really awful venue that just has been there since day one. That, I mean, honestly looks like, you know, 1990s, somebody stuck it in amber. I mean, between the bad tile murals and the film posters, and it was just a bad venue.
Well,
so
you and I ate there a couple months before it closed, and was any of that memorable?
Well, you know, I'm pretty sure I got the Chinese food. I couldn't actually identify anything that was in the egg roll, which kind of frightened me.
Yeah, I think I got the meatloaf and braised ribs, and I don't think we could tell the difference between the two.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it was one of those.
Yeah. So it was just one of these things where you have this lackluster restaurant, but it is within, you know, the shadow of the Simpsons ride. And Mike West, you know, it was one of these things where they had really, really, really wanted to bump out the footprint. I got a quote here that, from Mike. It just basically, you know, it's just like, look, we'd wanted to do this and here was the opportunity. Mm-hmm. So let's go. So that they shut it down.
The International Food and Film Festival.
Yeah. And they just creep it out. But at the same time, it's like, look, we have to, people, you know, this is the first thing that really got built on the heels of, or land that got built on the heels of Hogsmeade, and the whole notion of, you know, well, look how people embrace the food there, whether it was the butter beer or the stuff at the Three Broomsticks or that sort of thing.
Right.
And so let's just commit. Let's, you know, food is such a huge part of the Simpsons world. Let's just go. And so Chef Steve Jason gets together with his team. They come up with 28, you know, different Simpsons themed items, whether it's, you know, and we're talking about, you know, setting up a microbrew so they could serve Duff beer, or figuring out how to do the Flaming Moe.
The Flaming Moe is classic. So it's orange soda, but and what makes it better is the addition of dry ice.
Well, yeah, but it the setup is ingenious because at the bottom of each cup, there's the equivalent of a sewer grate that's supposed to keep the dry ice separate, you know, separate from the beverage, but. Mm-hmm. Dry ice being dry ice, occasionally pieces break off, and there's, you know, as you're drinking this thing, there's always that unusual sensation of, there's something in my mouth that's actively foaming. And it's like, I don't think this is supposed to be happening.
I have bromide or whatever. Yeah. But that's it's fabulous. Now, I've never actually had the Duff beer, but you say it's a microbrewery?
Yeah, yeah. And
is it really?
Yeah, and in fact, I think they also offer Duff Dry, which, along with, I want to say Jolt Cola.
Sure.
But yeah, they went across the board. In fact, Steve Jason loves to tell the story of when they, and again, this was the problem. You're doing something in Florida, you've got to get the folks in, California sign off on it. So he and his team fly out to California and prep all of the food that they're going to be serving, these 28 items, and then bring them in to Gracie and set them up on a table. And there's this great story about the guy who wrote, he did a lot of the stuff for Krusty the Clown and wrote a lot of the jokes for Krusty Burger and walked in and saw the clogger, which was, the famous burger that's supposed to kill you. And he's like, oh my God, that's what I saw in my head while I was writing this. And it's like, made real. This is scary. So, just to stress here, yes, they did redo the International Food and Film Festival facility into what's now known as basically Fast Food Boulevard.
Okay.
And inside there you have, Cletus's Chicken Shack, the Frying Dutchman. You have Moe's is an actual separate walk-in facility that
you can get between the two.
Yeah. And with a bow to to the fact that you have to try to balance the clogger. So Lisa, who's the vegetarian of the Simpson family, actually has her little vegetarian restaurant facility. But again, it's kind of modeled after your classic food court, at the mall, except for Moe's, which again is the standalone. And because it's a theme park, you need bathrooms. To sort of hide the bathroom that was at the very end. That's where they sort of create a faux version of the Android's dungeon.
What's that? I've never.
Well, that's the comic book guy. In fact, one of the things I really like about the way the Simpsons, the Universal people were about bringing the Simpsons into the park during the construction phase of the Simpsons ride, and understanding that there were a lot of people who really loved the Back to the Future ride.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did to sort of acknowledge it during the changeout is that you may recall there was this fence with classic Simpsons characters, posed along it. And what they did is they put a comic book guy, the overweight guy, in Marty McFly's jacket from Back to the Future 2. So, if you were, a Back to the Future fan, it's like, oh, there's an acknowledgement. And actually the other thing, another weird twist on it. Some of the biggest fans on the planet of the Back to the Future ride actually work for Gracie Films. And when they found out that the Simpsons ride was going to replace Back to the Future the ride, they were like, look, we have to acknowledge this. There has to be something in the ride or in the queue that acknowledges what happens. And so they actually, there's this 3-minute long vignette in it where Professor Frink, actually drives a DeLorean back to try to stop, the changeout from happening. And what ends up happening is that here's Doc Brown out in front of the Institute of Future Technologies getting the small business loan that will keep the building open. And Professor Frink accidentally runs over the representative from the Small Business Association. And so Doc Brown is like, you idiot, now I'll have to sell to that mercenary clown. And what's genuinely great about this is that they reached out and they got Christopher Lloyd. So it's the real Doc Brown voicing Doc Brown. And so this is really sweet, kind of a tip of the hat to what was there before. But just understanding that, while they did the retool or the redo of International Food and Film Festival, they knew they needed more to sell the idea. So actually, in the land directly across the street from that old restaurant, they actually built brand new structures. So here you have Duff Gardens. And, you know, and again, you know, just I love the fact that not only did they, because you have to remember
it's,
that
it's a takeoff of Busch Gardens.
Right? It's a takeoff of Busch Gardens, but at the same time, because they twitted Disney during the original episode when the family went to Duff Gardens, you know, they, the characters that were walking through the parks were the seven Duffs. and so what do? In classic Disney style, here are topiaries, but they're of the seven Duffs outside of Duff Gardens.
It's beautiful.
It is. It is. And then to sort of put the cap on it and to make it into a really for real land, the last thing to be added in, the August of 2013 was the Kang and Kodos Twirl and Hurl, which is, your sort of Dumbo spinner, only the notion is that throughout the entire queue, you suddenly realize that, you know, you're not in line for a fun ride. You are, you know, you are helping out in the alien invasion to destroy Springfield. And again, to give you some idea of how hands-on, Matt Groening and James L. Brooks were, there was actually a meeting about, well, what color are Kang and Kodos? Because, you know, just it's like, you know, these are going to burn down in the floor of the sun, and this is the color we use in the television series. Right. And so, you know, they were completely on board with this. And which now brings us to Hollywood, you know, that this was such a huge success right out of the gate. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you that Duff Beer or Flaming Moe's sell quite as well as, Harry Potter, you know, the butter beer.
Right.
But this was an enormous success right out of the gate. And
was it?
So, yeah, I mean, you know, just they, you know, I don't know what this says about, you know, the American tourism market, but, you know, Moe's would open every morning at 11 a.m. and there would be a line out the door. All right. You know, people wanted a seat at that bar really bad. They wanted to get at the love tester machine. They wanted to get at that phone that sits at the end of the counter, where, you know, you can listen to Bart making prank calls. This was a success right out of the gate. So, you know, and meanwhile, in California, they're in the middle of this massive redo of the Upper Lot, which was this weird collection of you know, that there really was no master plan. In fact, I'll tell you flat out, I was in a meeting with James Murdy, the head of Universal Creative for Hollywood, and he said, look, there wasn't a master plan for the Upper Lot. And only 5 years ago, we decided to create one. And they've been slowly putting in each year.
They didn't have a master plan for the Upper Lot. Really?
Well, you know, in fact, what's kind of interesting, this year is the 50th anniversary of the launch of the tram tour.
Right.
And, you know, the Upper Lot really was where you sort of killed time before you went and did the tram. And, you know, Universal, you know, in a weird inversion of, you know, we've talked about with Disney Hollywood Studios, how, you know, that was a production facility that, you know, had theme park elements, which is now becoming a theme park. And in the case of Universal, I mean, this was, you know, a legitimate movie studio. And in fact, they only started offering tours because they were looking to create new revenue streams. And then when it became popular, you know, it's just this whole notion of, you know, when you can only take so many people at a time, you know, on the tram, you had to give them something to do. So they took parts of their upper lot and slowly built things like stunt shows or animal actors areas or, you know, places where you could have your photo taken in prompts. But it was just, there was never a plan. And now, you know, the notion of, okay, we really want to make this into something special. And remember, you know, when we're talking 5 years ago, you know, this is just when Harry Potter was about to open in 2010 at Universal's Islands Adventure. And they'd already seen that level of excitement. They knew they wanted to bring that to Hollywood, but they knew in order to do that, they had to pick just the right area, and they wanted to cozy up against the City Walk, so potentially when they did the Great Hall Dining Experience, they could bring people in from there. And from that locking that piece into place, that then became a, okay, so that affects everything else. And, you know, you want the center of the park to be easier to get through. I mean, if you remember going to Universal Studios in Hollywood, even, you know, 5 and 6 years ago, you'd get on the upper lot and it was this sort of tangle of buildings, you know, and you know, you'd have like a Flintstones rib shack right across from the, you know, a donkey, you know, a talking donkey from Shrek. It was this weird collection of elements that really didn't tell a story all that well. And it, you know, and it was honestly, it was hard to navigate. It was hard to find the staircase that'll take you down to the lower lot or find the tram tour. And they've addressed all of that now. In fact, there's a, they've just recently added a sort of a new style of signage that makes it that much easier to get through, you know, the park. Likewise, there's sort of a Carmen architectural language. They've created this new central plaza called the Universal Plaza that, that has a fountain that kids can play in during the summer, but this is also the spot where they'll stage Grinchmas, you know, in November and December. It's also queue area for Halloween Horror Nights in, you know, September and October. It's very, very smart design, and they've been very systematic about, you know, how they've done this. I mean, you know, a year or two ago, they brought, the Despicable Me, the ride there and built that in there. You know, retooled the old Terminator building and even built a super silly fun land off of this thing. So it's, again, the idea is whatever they add now isn't just a ride. It's a land. So circling back to Springfield, this is what they've done here. In fact, you know, they take where the Springfield ride sits in the park and have retrofitted a street that sort of focuses you right toward you know, so as you walk into the land, to your right will be, you know, the Krusty Burger and Moe's and Cletus's Chicken Shack. And to your left will be, Phineas T. Butter, Buttermilk's, Ice Cream Parlor and Luigi's Pizza Parlor and Duff Gardens.
Oh, pizza. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, you know, the nice thing is because it curves around Hogsmeade, you're actually, as you follow the street, you know, and you know, you continue past Cletus's toward the, you know, toward the Springfield Police Station where Snake will be escaping twice daily. that's what directs you to the lower lot. And it's just, I mean, it's really, really smart design that is going to look like it's always been there.
Really?
And what's really fun right now is that they've been, you know, for the better part of this month, they've been soft opening, you know, allowing people to come in. Now, mind you, they've been propping as they've been going. I mean, for example, the day I was there, they were training people to use the kitchen at Krusty Burger, but they were talking about how later that day they were going to be installing a 10-foot-tall talking clown head. That,
you know, first it's training employees, then it's talking clown head.
You know, but yeah, this is what dangles over the ordering area. So as you're ordering, Krusty is going to be hassling you from above.
Really?
Oh,
that's funny.
But, you know, the other thing that was fascinating is the day after I was visiting, this was a Monday, they were going to having their first test of whether or not the restaurant was really up to the task of handling customers. I mean, so, you know, evidently this is what Universal does whenever they're launching a new restaurant. They just tell all, you know, all of the cast members, or to me, Universal is team members. Disney has cast members.
Right.
All of the team members that, you know, look, if you, you know, we want as many of you as possible to show up at the restaurant at 11:30 this morning, and we're going to simulate a lunchtime slam. And, you know, we'll buy your dinner, you know, we'll buy your lunch, but we need you in line, you know, and, you know, we need you to, you know, don't get an easy order. Order something complicated, you know, burgers without cheese or fish without fish, whatever you're going to do.
Fish without breading. Yeah.
There you go. You know, and go forward from there. And evidently the test went great. And since then they've continued the propping, and oddly enough, the one of the favorite photo spots. I mean, a lot of the photo spots that people enjoyed from Florida have been replicated. You know, for example, you're going to have the police cruiser, you know, that's crashed into the hydrant. That's a water feature, but there's going to be a Chief Wiggum's right there. But they've created some new ones. And in fact, the one that seems to be popping up on social media and all over the place is the spider pig, where, you know, if you go Cletus's, there's a pig glued to the ceiling. You know, and everybody is like, I have to have my picture taken with Spider Pig. And it's like, okay. But when I was being walked through by the production designer, that they were talking about how with each restaurant they took into, you know, and we got upstairs into the upstairs dining areas, mm-hmm. Which each supposedly will seat 200 people. So you've got 600 seats upstairs over each of these restaurants, which really is going to help out come, you know, lunch and dinner time. But they were talking about how each individual character was tried to be reflected in its restaurant. I mean, for example, he was taking me upstairs and walking me through the dining room for Cletus's Chicken Shack. And he mentioned that, well, Cletus had done all the wiring for the restaurant himself. And given that he wasn't really all that skilled at bending conduit, you know, all the electrical fixtures just would go straight. But on the other hand, because he couldn't get the hang of hanging flat screen televisions, you know, all of them were just a little off kilter because Cletus just couldn't figure out how to do this properly. So the
electrical outlets are all straight, and the
straight, and the televisions are all bent at an angle. So
that's beautiful.
You know, and at the same time, because Cletus's place is made out of really rough hewn wood, but you walk just across the way and you're in the Krusty Lou, you know, cafeteria, and it's this wonderful pseudo time capsule of, you know, 40s and 50s Hollywood, just, you know, the way the booths are done and, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, the whole notion is this is where Krusty was willing to spend his money because he worked here, you know, and at the same time, because he was putting his trophies up on display, his fireman's cap and all that, you know, just this was, it had to be classy, or at least as classy as a mercenary clown could be. But at the same time, remember that in a weird sort of way, this is going to be the berm for, the Wizarding World of Harry Potter for Hollywood. And what was really kind of striking, as we entered, was to get a sort of a peek into Potter, and they are really well far along, Len. I mean,
well, it's supposed to open this year, yeah. So,
well, yeah, but the interesting thing is Universal's been kind of cagey about when it's opening next year. In fact, you know, a lot of people have been reading into the fact that Universal is changing the way it sells its annual passes in late March, early April of 2016, and are suggesting that because they anticipate what's about to happen, that the opening, it'll officially open in that window. We're talking late March, early April of 2016. But if you look at the rock work, if you look over the construction fence at, you know, the entrance arch is in place, the rooftops are in place, the snow is in place, the mm-hmm. chimneys are in place at a lot of the buildings, at least to the front, they are very far along. So,
wow.
I would anticipate, late winter, early spring, we are probably going to see some soft opening there.
Yeah, and so when it opened in – when Diagon Alley opened, one of the issues with it was that they didn't really give a definitive date. Mm-hmm. And it opened in, what, July, right? July
yep.
2014. Mm-hmm. The issue was that people couldn't plan around it because Universal didn't give an opening date until, I mean, well into late spring, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And you know, people had already planned their summer vacations by then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you didn't see the pop of attendance that you might have because of that, because people didn't know when they would go. So
It's interesting you mention that, because talking with Universal insiders, you know, because the opening of Diagon Alley actually slipped about 6 weeks, you know, that they really did want to have that open, you know, the first week of June or thereabouts, because they knew if they opened it in June, they could at least, you know, put the word out, and then, you know, they'd get really strong July, August. But because it slipped and they weren't able to announce an official opening date almost till July 4th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be about 3 weeks before it opened, something like that.
Yeah, it did hurt their summer. But on the other hand, fall and winter and going into the spring have never been stronger at Universal Orlando. And, you know, just on the QT, they're going to be announcing a fairly sizable attraction shortly. In fact, when this show airs, they will have announced it. And on the back of that, there will be the 25th anniversary of the resort coming up. So they're about to have a very strong summer. But, you know, again, circling back to Universal Hollywood, you know, right now it's more about, for example, where the jail is in Springfield. Right next to that, you can see the backmost buildings for the Wizarding World. And there are, the horticulture apartment's about to get in there and plant, you know, a ridiculous number of pine trees and such to try to sort of, you know, create an artificial berm between the two areas. But they really are right against one another. And I think we've talked earlier on previous shows that, that it, you know, what's really bizarre is that the three broomsticks and the three Chicken Shack, Moe's, and Krusty Burger are going to share a kitchen. And, I think we were talking about how I just love for somebody to slip up and be in the three broomsticks and bring me a clogger and a flaming Moe.
Yeah, instead of the corn on the cob, which is probably pretty delicious.
There you go. But it's just, you know, when fictions collide and, you know, just,
I see a crossover episode here of, if this was a Cartoon Network and this was Adult Swim, they would totally have done it by now.
Very true. Very true.
Fantastic.
But again, that's, seriously, I just to sort of take a step back here. The thing that's most impressive about what they've done at Universal Hollywood is, again, the upper lot, which was just this tangle. I mean, don't get me wrong, they had that wonderful entrance. You go through the arch, and there's the statue, and they had their retail corridor. But as soon as you got past the retail corridor, things really fell apart. And right now, it's all about creating a unified whole. In fact, they just pulled down Castle Dracula, which used to be their year-round horror theme walkthrough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also going to be an attraction to be named later. But, you know, the notion is that, after Potter opens, there'll be yet another ride dropping in there that'll surprise and delight visitors to Universal Hollywood.
Really?
And, you know, this coupled with the higher ramp that's coming off of the 10, this coupled with the brand new giant parking garage that's being built, just to give people who are Springfield fans and Harry Potter fans somewhere else to park. I think the thing that really kind of puts a button on this whole thing, I was just talking with somebody who worked in publicity at Universal,
mm-hmm.
and they were talking about how just in the past year, they've decided to stop advertising City Walk.
Really? Well, there's not much there. I mean, there's a handful of restaurants, right?
Well, but here's the thing, Len. They're not. It's not that they've given up on promoting it. It's the fact that there has been such a steady uptick in attendance that, you know, all of these restaurants and shops and movie theaters are now full.
Oh, really? And, so they can't handle more people.
Well, it's just that what they've done to the park has become such a strong draw,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, City Walk, which used to struggle during the off times, now finds itself with more than it can handle. And in fact, they had an interesting conversation with the folks at City Walk who were like, why aren't you advertising? And it's like, you don't need it, you know, and it's like, you know, we're doing our job. Enjoy it. And Yeah. So, and as busy as they are now, it's going to be hard to imagine where they're going to be come the summer of 2016 with Potter open and Springfield and, you know, and the new nighttime tram tour, which we didn't even talk about, which starts on July 4th. You know, they've just spent the last year and a half going through the backlot and creating all of this hidden in place lighting that will come on after dark. And, it's going to be a whole new experience. They've actually a brand new script, brand new vignettes, you know, an exciting new way to experience the tram, which is, you know, again, 50th anniversary this year. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's, and again, to just kind of bring this thing full circle, you know, there's a number of folks at Disney right now who, you know, yes, you know, Disneyland is going to be celebrating its 60th anniversary, and there's a new version of World of Color, and there's a new fireworks show, and there's a new parade, and that'll be enough to bring the locals out for this year. But the real worry right now is, like, what do we have coming for 2016? And yeah, there's this noticeable gap.
This is it. I mean, this is we've talked about this for World, but we know that Disneyland and DCA are going to get some version of, you know, some sort of Star Wars / Marvel thing. But, yes, you know, at the pace that Disney goes, it's 2015. I mean, you're looking at 2020,
mm-hmm,
you know, 2019, 2020 until they do something. And that's a long time for Disney to have to deal with Harry Potter in California. Yeah.
I know that there is, you know, the Marvel Street and supposedly a coaster that's going to be a component of that, that's supposed to go in behind Tower of Terror. But again, you know, you don't go to Bob's Big House of Coasters and, you know, just give me that and we'll put it up next weekend in the backyard.
No, and they've got a theme that they've got. I mean, you know how Disney operates. Yeah. It's going to take them four years to get anything built.
So, but the upside is that gives us plenty of talk to talk about over the next 4 years as they build it. And then, you know, they have to do battle with Universal. And I know that sounds weird for Disney fans to think about Disney having serious competition in that market, but let's be blunt here. I mean, the thing about Disneyland is it's the world's most famous regional theme park. And, you know, with most of its guests coming from 100 miles away, for a competitor to have, you know, two amazing new lands arrive inside of 8 months, you know, Springfield, USA opening just ahead of, you know, the Wizarding World of Harry Potter Hogsmeade. That's a hard thing.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that they've got Fast and Furious. They've got other things that you know, coming up. Supposedly, we'll see what happens, but
yeah. So anyway, there you go. And again, that should be, as the show goes up, you know, finishing its soft opening and officially opening. And it'll be interesting to hear what you folks think about this version of Springfield. Based on what I saw, it is definitely a step up from what they did at Universal Studios Florida, which honestly is great fun unto itself. So just interested to hear what you folks have to say about the Universal Hollywood version.
Cool. Jim, thanks very much for the update. Let's I think you and I were talking about heading out there, maybe in a little bit to see what's going on.
Yeah, that is the plan. In fact, God help us, more walk around shows.
So. It should be fun. All right, you've been listening to the Unofficial Guide to Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Please go into iTunes and Stitcher and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. We always like to hear that feedback. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.
Take care, guys.